Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A Michigan couple's affair leads to two grisly murders by heroin injection in this true crime account from the acclaimed author of Lobster Boy. When Carol Giles' friend Nancy Billiter was found dead, she had been bound, sexually violated, and injected with a lethal dose of battery acid and heroin. Detectives in Michigan traced Billiter's death back to Giles and her boyfriend, Tim Collier. Police also learned that the diabolical duo shared another secret. They had murdered Giles' husband, Jesse. Jesse, who had died months before Billiter, was disinterred, and an autopsy proved he had been given a lethal shot of heroin instead of his prescribed insulin. Homebound and diabetic, Jesse was a heroin dealer. Police determined that Giles, who had fed up with taking care of her husband and children, along with her lover, Collier, had stolen the final dose from Jesse's own drug supply. The cops surmised that Billiter's death might have been due to her knowledge of the couple's plot. In their dramatic trial, Giles and Collier turned against each other, but both were eventually convicted of murder. The book that we're featuring this evening is Needlework, Battery Acid, Heroin, and Double Murder, with my special guest journalist and author, Fred Rosen. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Fred Rosen.
And Zupansky, any time that I get to go on your show is a good day. Okay, and I really appreciate this opportunity. I have to just tell you that, I just have to mention this to everybody that's listening, because you have such an incredible listenership across the world, and I just want to say that the great thing is, ladies and gentlemen, this gentleman reads every book that he talks about. And not everybody who does what he does do that. So I just wanted to say that. Okay, and I'm finished.
Thank you very much, Fred. It's an honor to read them. I can't understand why anybody wouldn't read them in their entirety, because many, many stories right to the very end, you're not quite sure what's going to happen, and that's the beauty of it. Let's get to this. This is November 14th, 1997. You open this in Michigan, West Bloomfield, a township outside of Detroit,
right.
Michigan. Right. And this is Genesee County Sheriff Department in Genesee, Michigan as well. Tell us about the fishermen and what they find one day. And you introduce a detective, Shanlian. Tell us a little bit about him and what the fishermen tell them that they find. Tell us about what they find.
Well, what happens is these people are just out, it's in the winter, and, they, for whatever reason, it's the winter, and they go out fishing and in a local river. And what happens, they see something covered on the trail they're on, going into this park. It's something, and they're not sure what it is. And then they get closer, and they realize it's a human body. And so these people are just shocked, as anybody would be. And the next thing you know, they call the cops, and Kevin Shanlian is a detective for the local police department, and you asked me to tell you a little bit about the guy. Well, I got to tell you, I was reading the book again, Dan, and I can't believe I didn't put this in. But what I put in was the fact that Shanlian, unlike, you know, cops in the movies and detectives and so forth, and TV shows, he keeps his gun in his desk. He only takes it out when he's got to go out into the field. And I remembered something. I didn't put this in. That's exactly what Andy Griffith did in the Andy Griffith Show. I'm looking at this and I'm going, gee, Fred, why didn't you mention that? But anyway, the point is, Shanlian gets involved, and he's one of these incredible police officers, detectives that you see occasionally. I won't say often, but occasionally. The kind of person who uses everything in their power to bring justice to the dead.
Right. Now, you talk about the body that they find, and Shanley and other officers are at the scene. They find this body that was, as they discover, looked like somebody was trying to burn the body. They made a fuse out of leaves, but the fire stopped at the asphalt, so the body was not burnt at all whatsoever, really. The police took vehicle impressions in this parking lot, and this place where this was next to Flint, Michigan, and you write about the difference between West Bloomfield and Flint. Flint, one of the highest per capita murder rates in the U.S., so people have heard about Flint, Michigan. But they found this woman with face bloody and bruised. Her left eye had been bruised, multiple lacerations. Around her neck, you write that she had a Coke spoon around her neck.
Yes.
We remember those from the 70s and the 80s. She was wrapped up in a bedspread, a flowered bedspread. Her underpants were pulled down. Her bra and her top were still up. But there were small wounds, and it looked like burn wounds. And so right away, this is they have no idea who this woman is. Obviously, the perpetrators tried to burn the evidence and the person. So Shanlian is now looking for somebody like Dr. Mueller, the medical examiner, to take a look and see what they can determine from that. Tell us what Shanlian and the Dr. Mueller discover about the body and its condition and what might have happened to this person.
Yes, what they find as far as the body, certainly a cursory examination showed that the decedent had been beaten a lot, and then they discovered that there were various injection sites. Man, you can't make this up, Dan. It's true crime. With burn marks, over those injection sites. But the most important piece of evidence, and it shows, of course, that we're not dealing with criminal masterminds doing this, was the fact that she was wearing a T-shirt that said South Boulevard Station. Okay? You know, and it was pretty easy for Shanlian to figure out, let's look that one up. And of course they found that it was a restaurant south of Flint, and that led them to the identification of the body, but it still was a long way from there to figuring out who done it.
Yeah. You talk about right away when they identify the person as Nancy Billiter.
Yes.
They soon talk to a friend named Carol.
Oh, boy.
And so they talk to a few people. They talk to Carol, and they talk to a person named Skip Selbach. And, of course, they're talking to people at work to see what happened that evening. So what did they determine that evening when she did go to work and then when she left? What did they determine happened from one time to the other?
Okay, what they determined was she went to work. She was living with, at that point, temporarily, with her friend Carol Giles in West Bloomfield Township, Michigan. And she lived with her mother, but Carol's husband had died recently, so she'd moved in to help her out. Giles had two kids. And, of course, she also had a boyfriend named Tim Collier. And so what occurs here is that Nancy Billiter has a very big heart. And so she wants to go and help her friend. And that leads to what it leads to.
Now, you talk about Carol's background, talking about 15 years old and just this troubled background. Tell us a little bit about her background with her father and the allegations she makes against him. And then in light of this troubled background at 15 years old, who does she meet?
Oh, boy. You know, I'll tell you something. You know, when you read, you know, look, when you read this stuff in police reports and you talk to the police and they give you the info, if you put it together and you got a heart, and that's important in this work, I feel, Dan, it really can get to you. And what happens in Carol Giles' case is she alleges that her father had incested her. I mean, I have trouble even saying it, okay? And what happens is, she wants to get the heck out of the house, duh. And again, this is in Michigan. And so she winds up meeting a guy who's, Jesse Giles is, I think, about 19 years or 20 years older than her. So she meets this guy, Jesse Giles, who's and this is relevant because of what happens later. He's very overweight. We're talking, oh boy, you know, short guy, not, you know, 5'6", maybe, over 300 pounds. Diabetic, okay? But he is basically like the father to her she never had. That's what's so interesting about this, how she's repeating the pattern of going somebody, and this guy is abusive to her in various ways, and he's a drug dealer. I will also tell you that he's the smartest drug dealer I've ever written about. We can talk about that later. But it's a very interesting relationship that way. You know, how a woman who's abused, it could be a guy, it makes no difference. Person, you know, you don't have any self-esteem. It's understandable. So what do? You try to find a way out. And how does she find a way out? She goes with a drug dealer who's more than twice her age.
You also talk about that they become business associates, so which lends you the idea that she's not just an innocent bystander in his drug business.
At
the time of his death, he's over 400 pounds, you write, about 450 pounds. So he's quite sickly and diabetic and inactive, we'll say, to say the least. But also that, keeping with the abuse, that often he prostitutes her out as a favor to some of his drug clients. So that's part of it.
You know what, Dan, thank you. You know, it's like, sometimes I feel like the most naive guy in the world when I find out stuff like this. I go, I didn't know about this. And that's, you know, I didn't know that drug dealers would have a woman close to them who they would then prostitute out. And that's exactly what happened here. And again, what's so interesting, you know, everybody goes through life with decisions to make, Dan, no matter what the hand is we're dealt in terms of our backgrounds. Well, she said, okay, I'm going to marry this guy. You know, and she also decided to marry, we should also mention this guy is African-American, and that was an affront allegedly to her father at that point in time. So here's a situation where she's basically trying to work at her problems as she goes forward and doesn't have the skills to do it. You know, you sort of got to, you know, that's an interesting one too, because there's nothing in the record regarding that I've seen how she did in school. That would be interesting, you know, now that we're talking about it. You know, did anybody ever notice anything? You know, did she ever report anything? But so, you know, I didn't find anything like that when I was writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Continuing with this, Nancy's mother is contacted. Mm. The police, of course, got the tough job of knocking on the door. It's Mrs. Phyllis Burke. And they say, listen, your daughter Nancy's been murdered. When was the last time you saw her? And as you write in the book, a sadder part of this is, tell us a little bit about this last thing that they remember, that the mother remembers about the daughter.
I'm trying to remember. I reread the book today, but I don't remember all the details except for this.
There was an argument, and the last time they saw each other, they argued. So again, just the last memory of her daughter was this regrettable
argument. Thanks, Dan. Thanks. Yes, they had an argument, and you know, I can't even imagine what that would be like. You know, to lose. You know, God forbid, losing a child. But let alone after having had an argument, you know, and they were having problems and so forth, there's never going to be any closure. There's never going to be any closure. And it points up to me all the, for lack of a better term, the collateral damage in a case like, well, just like in any case, Dan. I mean, the family, you know, the family, and, you know, and having the family having to deal with this stuff, and you know, how the heck do you deal with it? I mean, I've actually got a situation in my family where I feel like somebody, a cousin of mine was murdered, but it's specious, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you got a very basic situation here. This woman was murdered.
You talk about Detective Melky and Edwards, and they're talking to Mrs. Burke. Now, Nancy's siblings, Susan, Karen, and Doug, they talk to the detectives and say, yes, she had a coke problem. So now the police understand that the cocaine might have something to do with this, but she definitely... she has a coke problem. She had a child out of wedlock.
Yes.
And this is, she tried to raise her on her own, and she worked hard, and she was a waitress. She had been married 10 years before, and her mother took care of Nancy's baby. What eventually police find out from talking to people at work is that someone had driven her home. What they find out is about, again, that Carol Giles is Nancy's roommate, so they finally find out where she lives, knock on the door, and they get to talk to her.
Well, if I may interrupt for a second, they don't knock on the door. What they do is, when they found out that Giles was the roommate, quote-unquote, man, they, you know, it's like in the movies. They drove their car right up, you know, behind hers, and she was just on her way out. And that's when they started talking to her. And that's, you know, the beginning of, you know, what the whole plot is.
It's interesting, too, that these, again, when you mentioned that these aren't the brightest criminals around, while the police take advantage of that, their lack of experience, especially Carol's lack of experience with the law. So they ask her if she has any drugs or guns. And she does not have to answer questions. She does not have to submit to a search. But if she volunteers this information, she volunteers and offers to be and replies that she will be searched, then that's certainly what the police will do. So what do they find on her person?
Oh, well, they find drugs, what do you call it, crack.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, Dan, this was an education. I don't know anything about crack. So, you know, I mean, you know, the most I've ever done is weed. But, you know, it's all about crack, okay? And, and then they also find she's got a gun.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a gun. And, and then when they they find it in the car, they find battery acid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, excuse me, you know, what's that doing here? So it, you know, they find some stuff that none of it makes any sense. I mean, and of course, I'm sure that, you know, I didn't get into it at the time, but I'm sure she didn't have a license to carry the weapon, you know what I mean? And neither did her boyfriend, Collier, who had an automatic that he usually kept in his waistband. You know, to me, Dan, what it says to me is how... You know, on one hand, you can have people like Tim Collier who grow up, for whatever reason, as bad guys. On the other hand, you get people like Carol Giles who get abused, and then what does that lead to? Making wrong decisions as an adult that leads to murder. Whoa, you know?
We will talk about this, but I also think that there's an incredible, and this won't be a surprise to anybody, but there's an incredible reaction to these drugs. I think a person into the throes of addiction could leave their children like these people do for hours and hours to be able to go do what they need to do. But that is just one of the things. I mean, Carol talks about her children later like she's a caring mother, but that's not the case. That's a story, but. Let's get back to this with Carol, because it really comes down to the unsophistication, the lack of sophistication of Carol, and savvy police as well. Because I got to say, there was a point here, and it becomes an issue later, where she may ask for a lawyer. She may ask for a lawyer,
right.
And all of this would go away, and all this information about Tim and Nancy and what really happened wouldn't happen. And then they ask, well, you can have a lawyer, or you could talk to a detective.
Oh, man.
Tell us just a little bit about this little bit of wordplay to be able to comfort her, this strategy to be able to get the information they needed to get from her.
You know what? This is the reason why whenever I do an interview with you, I have to read the whole book again, because otherwise I'm not prepared. And I, of course, I just read that again. And basically, what we're saying here is that they needed to know what she was thinking. Ask the question again. I just got off track for a sec. Ask the question again.
They have a dilemma. There is talk. You know, even though they've coaxed her in this interview to get quite a bit of information,
at some point
she has the opportunity to pick a lawyer, and they pose a question to her to get her not to pick the lawyer. It's pretty ingenious, very simple. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what happens is, thank you, what happens is, because I tend to get off track, that's where you come back and get me on track. What happens is, every time a person, it turns out that, at least in Michigan, anytime they interview a suspect, they give them their rights. So every single time they do that, and it, because the individual is interviewed a number of times, it's not uncommon. Well, what happens here is, Carol Giles requests a lawyer. Now, once you request a lawyer in the United States, the interrogation is supposed to stop, and you can't ask them any more questions. Well, the detective in this case says, we can get you a lawyer, but we also have a detective you can talk to. He's right outside over here. And she says, okay, I'll talk to the detective. It was an absolutely brilliant piece of police work. Didn't violate the suspect's rights. And then she wound up talking to the detective and gave some interesting information about what was going on.
Now, Carol says that night, she right away is telling police a story. And the police just have a sense that it's not the complete story. There's something off with it. But the story she has is pretty horrifying, is that Nancy got home around 11 p.m. that night, and Nancy and Tim went to the basement and they smoked some crack. And Tim was upset with Nancy. A burglary had happened while Tim and she were
right.
in California on vacation. So Tim was accusing her of stealing a VCR.
Yes.
And apparently, she says, first off, that Nancy's called someone on the phone about 1:30 a.m., and then the guy picked her up.
Mm-hmm.
But they know that there's more to this story, obviously. Well, they've searched the Carol's car. She has a Cadillac and she has a Sable. And again, like you had mentioned, they find this battery acid.
Oof.
And they find a handgun. And then they find her driver's license under the driver's seat. So there's more to the story, and she talks more. They keep pushing her for more information.
Yes, they do, and actually you're making a very, very, very good point, which is, and I didn't say this in the book, but you're making a good point, which is what they're doing here is separating or trying to separate the two suspects who they know are involved, but they're trying to separate them emotionally so they can get the truth out of one, at least one of the suspects. Because one thing they know for sure, they know that Collier is a really bad guy. And it isn't so much the guy's record or it's the vibes, okay? It's the vibes. And all of the information that we've discussed regarding Carol Giles' background, the police had all this information. So they knew exactly what they were dealing with. You know, they knew exactly what they were dealing with. And, you know, so it was a challenge to put it all together, they met the challenge.
While they have her in custody, of course, they're going to look for Tim Collier, and they do find him. And, of course, again, the unsophisticated prisoners that they are, they read him
mm-hmm.
her statement, Carol's statement, and he doesn't say anything.
Right.
And he has an ability to lawyer up, which would have been probably a super smart idea. And yet, what does he do?
As I recall, he makes a statement.
Absolutely. And of course, as you allude to in the description and synopsis, of course, he tries to blame. He thinks, geez, I'm going to spend, there is no death penalty here, but I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison. I'm going to try to get in front of this.
Right.
And put the blame on Carol.
Yeah, and I think we should explain that to the listeners that Michigan, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the states that got rid of the death penalty. I wrote about it in my Atlas of Crime. I want to say it's at least about 150 years ago. You know what I mean? So
right.
they don't have the death penalty, folks, but what they do have is a thing they call natural life. And so in a situation like this, what would happen is if the bad guy and girl are convicted, they not only go to jail for the rest of their life, they'll never get out on parole. It's natural life. That's it. Mm-hmm. They're throwing the key away, folks. So it's a big thing. You know, it's a big thing. And, of course, both defendants are going to go against each other because, you know, they want to get a leg up if there's some way to get a leg up. So, actually, as we're talking about it right now, I realize there's no way to get a leg up on any of this stuff. I mean, look at what they're charged with. They're charged with murder one, you know. There's no negotiating here. There's no negotiating. No. And there's something else I should also mention, which I didn't talk about in the book. I discovered this much later, Dan. Most times when you're looking at the American criminal justice system, usually, you say, okay, the North is liberal, the West is liberal, or the West Coast, whatever, and the South is conservative, blah, blah, blah. Well, here's a fact. Michigan is a very conservative place. So that's very, very important in a situation like that, like this, where you're talking about some individuals who are about to come up on charges of murder one, murder one for two individuals, you know, I mean, which that's a lot, at least I think so.
Absolutely. What we talked about, what you write about in the book too, is that Nancy moves in on the premise that she's helping out her friend get over the grieving of her husband that died by natural causes of a heart attack. So she's grieving and moving in. But shortly after Jesse's death, her husband's death, Tim moves in as well. And in the description, in the further interviews, we're hearing more and more. Well, we will talk about Tim's interview and what he has to say too. But Carol starts talking about how, as she's being pushed by the detectives, on how this came to be, that what made Tim so angry, and we also find out that the reason there was a lot of this trouble is because they went to California. She babysat for them because she owed Tim a couple $100 for drugs, so they thought this would be a good way. And then while they were away, they got a call from her, and he said, "Well, there's been a break and enter." And when they got back, there was one piece of evidence in their mind that proved that she was a thief, and it was shaped in a Coke bottle. Tell us about this quite important murder weapon.
Wow. Oh, boy. Well, there was a piggy bank shaped like a Coke bottle. Now, Nancy Billiter claimed that somebody had broken in and stolen some stuff. Well, and when Carol and Tim came back from their West Coast jaunt, Carol discovered the piggy bank in Nancy's car. And she's going, "What the heck is this doing here?" Well, later on, oh boy, it becomes a murder weapon. Carol will eventually use it to beat Nancy with, which is linked forensically, which, of course, is, you know, which I always find interesting, by the way, Dan. You know, I love it when they can do that stuff, you know. It's almost like watching a true crime TV show and it's real, you know. But you know what I'm saying. This is, oh man, so that's a murder weapon. And what's very interesting about that, oh man, I'm glad you reminded me, is that when the detectives are looking at what might have been used as a murder weapon, that is, Nancy was beaten, face, body, etc. And the bank comes up, the piggy bank, when Carol gives a confession to the cops regarding finding the piggy bank. Okay. Well, what happens is one of the detectives, one of the detectives, Messina, I think it's Messina, what he does is he goes back and he looks at the crime scene photos because nobody knows where this bank is. And you know what he finds? He finds it's in this bookcase, and they go to the house. The murder scene, they get it and they test it, and you know, next thing you know, they've got themselves one of the murder weapons. Now, it's very interesting. It was a really terrific piece of, I think it was a terrific piece of detective work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't happen very often in real life, you know?
Absolutely. Let's use this, Fred, as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. America has fallen in love with Best Fiends, the 5-star rated mobile puzzle game. Discover the world of Best Fiends and its cute characters in this fiendishly fun, free-to-download mobile puzzle game. Immediately, I noticed the vivid colors and the impressive visual style of Best Fiends. From the very, very start of playing, it's a very cool story, but it's the challenge and the puzzle solving that's kept me interested. There's 1,400 levels, but you don't need to be a gamer to really enjoy playing this. I'm a novice. I'm always progressing, and it's a lot of fun. Thousands of fun, challenging levels that require you to use your brain. Anyone can play this game, from kids to older adults, but it's made for adults. 5-star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Over 90 million downloads globally. Play offline anywhere. Perfect when you want to squeeze in another level on the go or to play on a plane or in the subway. Don't miss out on all the must-play game of the year. Solve thousands of fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. 5-star rated mobile game on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Download free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends, without the R, Best Fiends. Now, when we last left off, the police have Carol in custody. They have Tim in custody, and they're hearing a story of Tim's paranoia, Tim's homophobic rants that Nancy and Carol are lovers, mm-hmm. and he just
yes.
knows it, and he tries to arrange a threesome, but it doesn't work out, and he is angry. And it looks like he's angry. He tells Carol about, and of course she's weaving a story now that she was so frightened by this person she had to do all of his bidding, and all of his orders she had to obey. But she talks about how he talks about killing 7 people in his background, being associated
yes.
with some gang in Detroit where he gets his drugs from, and offering to kill her father for the molestation.
Yes.
But then we hear about Jesse Giles. Now, what do we hear about Jesse Giles and Nancy's involvement and Tim's involvement?
Well, this will eventually come out as the case proceeds toward trial. It's funny, as you're saying this, I was saying to myself, do I tell this to Dan or not? But as I was reading the book again, and I hadn't read it in a long time, okay? I was reminded about how much I was influenced growing up by the novels of Raymond Chandler, who created Philip Marlowe, the archetypal Hollywood detective. He used to say, Chandler, when the plot lags, always have a man come through the door with a gun. Well, you know, as I'm getting into this, you know, and I'm taking a look at this whole thing, what's so interesting to me is that Collier keeps bragging about this quote-unquote gang background, like you said, where he killed seven people, okay? There's no evidence of this. I didn't find anything, you know, in the way of evidence of that whatsoever. On the other hand, Giles, his girlfriend, when the time came to make a decision about killing two individuals, and Jesse Giles, her husband, she didn't hesitate. What she did was she spoke to Tim about it, and because she was already having an affair with him, and she was having problems with Jesse for whatever reason. And you know what? As we're talking about it, I'm thinking to myself, this is displacement psychologically. She really wanted to kill her father. Well, she decided to kill her husband, who essentially was the same person. How does she do it? Tim gives her some heroin, puts it into a syringe because Jesse is a diabetic. She gives him injections. So she gives him a hot shot. You know, and the next thing you know, he dies. You know, well, it's not so fast as that. He doesn't die immediately, but she winds up talking to Tim about it on the phone and so forth. Tim will later say that he had nothing to do with any of this, which is a bunch of crap. But they talk about it, you know, and it's very clear that what you have here is two individuals conspiring to murder a third individual, which is exactly what happens.
You introduce a detective that's important to this case, obviously, this Detective Helton.
Yes.
And so he is looking, and he realizes, too, that he talks to everybody. He talks to Jesse's sister, who has the children. Her name is Maddie Marion. He is single-handedly getting to the truth with these two people and with his investigation with other people that have information as well. They turn up a person of importance named Upchurch, his uncle.
Yes.
Tim's uncle. Tell us about Tim's uncle and what they get from him.
Well, Tim's uncle is over in Flint, and actually, it turns out it's his step uncle, but whatever. And what happens is Tim hangs out there, and he hangs out there with Carol in the middle of trying to get disposed of Nancy Billiter's body. And what happens is Tim goes to a gas station at some point before he gets to his uncle's, and he fills up a jug with, you know, one of those 10-gallon jugs with gasoline, and he's also got some lighter fluid. And what happens is after they try to dispose of Nancy's body by putting it into this park, pouring gasoline on her, and then a trail of twigs and it was pretty stupid, a trail of twigs and dead leaves, which they tried to light up with the lighter fluid and so forth, which didn't work. What Tim does is he takes the lighter fluid after that and the other stuff and takes it over to his uncle's house. The lighter fluid and the gasoline, what's left in the can, and he leaves it at his uncle's. And eventually the police wind up talking to Upchurch about it. And he tells them the whole, you know, he doesn't have very much to tell them, but he tells them that, you know, Tim had left this stuff there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, too, there's a statement where they say that they have some information that he's involved with the murder, and he says, only the gas is evidence. I could just imagine him saying, you know, like, not another sharp legal mind telling the police what evidence is, you know, so.
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, just as we're talking, I'm realizing something. What we're talking about here, and this has nothing to do with, you know, with race. We're talking about a criminal underclass in this country. And that's who these individuals were and are. That's it. You know, it's a criminal, because when as I'm reading, the, you know, what I wrote, and I'm thinking, how do people do this stuff? Well, you're bad guys, you know? You know, it's, and again, you take a look at Carol Giles, this is a situation where you actually have input, you actually have background on how a murderer grew up. That's pretty rare, you know what I mean? And then that's why the cops were very, very good in documenting everything, Dan. I mean, and this, you know, this doesn't happen, you know, in a lot of places. They were very, very cooperative. And that, again, it's been years since cops have been that cooperative on a case with me.
Right. Now, you talk about they get proof of the heroin and the insulin by exhuming Jesse's body.
Yes.
And so they have that information. They've both incriminated themselves, so they're both guilty of murder. But Tim's story sounds a whole lot less believable and isn't consistent with forensic evidence, whereas Carol's is. In this investigation and just at this trial, again, it looks like what possibly can be the motive, because even the police figured this can't be all of the motive for the torture that this Nancy Billiter endured.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. And see what, and that's very, yeah. What they real, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's the real point of this, which is what the police, the prosecutor, rather, feels and makes clear to the jury is that Nancy was, again, living with Giles and Collier for a while before she was murdered. And the police and the prosecutors make the argument that she overheard them talking about why Billiter had to die. I'm sorry, not Billiter. she overheard them talking about Jesse, the fact that they had killed Jesse. And the point is that they felt they couldn't have any, and Tim always said, you don't leave any witnesses. I mean, she said that over and over talking about him. So the point is that Nancy had to die because she'd overheard a conversation where they talked about killing Jesse Giles. That was it. And that's exactly what they presented to the jury, and the jury agreed and convicted them.
Yeah. You talk about that they had sort of a unique thing I haven't seen before, where they have two trials, two juries.
Right.
And making a decision at the same time. The two separate juries, so two, in a sense, two separate trials. Carol testifying, and later Tim testifying. Interesting, too, of course, it's very dramatic in the courtroom. You say that Nancy's relatives walked out of the courtroom at some point just because of the horrific nature of the description of the wounds and her treatment overall. Some of the testimony, they couldn't handle it, could they?
Well, no, they couldn't, and I also have to tell you that in doing the research on the book and the interviews, at least one of Nancy's sisters accused me of making money off of her dead sister because I was writing a book about it.
Sure.
And that's the first time that's ever happened to me, Dan. And I told her, I said, what's the difference between what I'm doing and what the Detroit Free Press and the local media does? You know, it was really interesting, you know. But I knew, of course, that the family was just, of course, totally traumatized by what just occurred.
Sure.
I mean, this is, yeah, I mean, you know, and I, again, this particular case really affected me. And one of the things I've realized as I read it again is, you know what? Anytime, you know, I won't take on a case unless it affects me emotionally. It's got to get to me. You know, it's got to get to me. And this did. And I think that's why, you know, I really got into it.
What I find out of this at the trial and Carol's statements, that obviously every criminal, every killer, every perpetrator tries to put themselves in a little better light, but no matter how much she can put herself in a better light, it doesn't make her look good at all. It makes her look horrible. She talks about not really, you know, not making a big deal of the theft and the burglary. And yet, when her enraged boyfriend, Tim, is saying, do you believe this woman? And she knows she has a gun. He has a gun now. And he's been talking about doing something to her. And again, so she writes, I think disingenuously, how much she wants to avoid this. But yet, when he asked her, well, do you believe her? And he said, well, no, I don't believe her. I don't believe you. And then she strikes her friend.
Mm-hmm.
So almost everything, as much as Tim is a horrifying lowlife, you know, a paranoid wannabe badass would say, horrible and horrific is Carol's attitude. And it's like you write in part of this book, you say you've never worked a case where you had so much detailed information provided to you.
Yeah,
meaning what
you
they
know,
said, what they did. Every graphic detail is in here, and this woman provided it.
You know what? I'll be very frank with you and with the listeners. I'm reading this and I'm going, gee, this would make a really good movie. But seriously, there's a lot of graphic detail. And again, the reason for that is because the police officers, Helton, Shanlian, Messina, they were extraordinarily open and helpful. And, you know, I lucked out. You know, I just lucked out with that. I mean, I realize that now. And they were just so helpful with this. And, you know, it's, because I'll tell you, you know, as I'm reading today, I'm thinking, she's got two kids, Carol Giles, and I'm thinking, gee, I wonder what happened to those kids, you know? I don't know. I haven't looked it up, you know, but maybe I will. You know, because now they're adults.
It is also incredible, the conversation that you have in here as well. When she talks about injecting the heroin into her obese husband's body, and he realizes, he says, what did you put in that insulin?
Yep.
So what's another remarkable thing, and this is not the only story, but this is a really prime example of how sniveling these people are. You know, they want to kill somebody. They're badass, but they got to sneak up and use all forms of deception that's within their grasp and then watch these people slowly die as a result of what they've done. And Carol did it twice.
I'm sitting here and I'm nodding vociferously. It is incredible. You know, these are sniveling cowards. You know, they really are. They're awful people. I mean, it's like, okay, you know, I'm sure, you know, you've talked to people who've been incested. You know, we've all talked to people. It's not an uncommon crime. Well, that doesn't mean you become a double murderer, you know? And
there seems to be...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. What do I know?
I think it seems to be the... Again, it's the nature of, not an inanimate object, but the people believe that they're completely addicted to this drug and will do anything. You can see the effect of not grasping reality at any point for this woman, for this Carol woman. I mean, it just seemed to be an altered reality for her life. And then when police came about, they used some charm to be able to get her to talk, but not like other cases. She didn't seem to be certainly mentally ill per se.
Well,
but it is incredible the effect of the drug and then the lackadaisical sort of attitude about everything after that. It seems like it just bore a hole in this woman's soul.
Dan, you know, you're getting into something that I hadn't really thought about, and you just reminded me of something, okay, about the use of that drug. Like I said earlier, the worst I've ever done is smoking weed. But I did one time in California. Inhale cocaine, okay?
Right. Sure.
And I turned around to the person who gave it to me, and I said, well, I don't feel any different, except I want to go downstairs and drive my car like Jim Rockford in the Rockford Files and turn it around real quick. And this guy said, Fred, you're not going to do it. That's my point. It's like when you lose control. You lose control when you take this crap, you know, and, you know, you can try to make an argument if you're a defense lawyer that the person's under the influence, but it ain't going to work, you know, and they didn't do that in this case, thank God.
Yeah, they both incriminated each other, and everything they said just reinforced forensic information and circumstantial evidence that they had against them. It was also very interesting, and you leave it open because it really is unknown. It looked like there was evidence of sodomy. They checked for Tim's DNA there and didn't find that. So that was just another. And you do write that Carol says that Tim, of course, again, why not? Her boyfriend told her, geez, I'm really curious about what it's like to have sex with a body. And, of course, Carol was not into that. So very, very interesting.
Well, everything I said, you know, that's all based on the records, you know. And you know what?
Yeah.
It's just as you're saying this, it's pretty disgusting, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, really. I mean, you know, this is, you know, it's really disgusting. And the fact, you know, and they don't know if he did or he didn't. And in a sense, it's not important because, look, the guy's in jail. That's it. He's not getting out. Never going to happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't even looked him up, but, you know, I can look him up again, but it makes no difference. He's just going to look a little bit older. Who cares? You know, you know, there are some people, you know, it's interesting as we're talking, Dan, you know, there are some times when I write about a bad guy, you know, a murderer or whatever, you're sort of sympathetic is not the right term, but, you know, you sort of, you know, you wonder a little about the person. Maybe you care a little about the person, for lack of, you know, a better term. Not these people. These are awful human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are awful human beings. And look, if this was a southern state, we're not having this conversation. They would have been executed a long time ago.
Yeah. You talk about the heroes in this, if there is such a thing, but the characters that are strong, the detectives, Tom Helton, Mike Messina, Kevin Shanahan. But you also spoke to Susan Garrison, which is Nancy's sibling. And you said you spoke to her in this book, and she was cooperative.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, tell us a little bit about what might have been said between you two about this.
You know what? it's a while back, but she was very cooperative. And what she really did for me was, it's really important. She painted a picture of her sister as a human being, not as a victim. And, you know, when you're writing about, you know, people who are murdered, it's very important to get that background. So she was extremely helpful that way. And that's why, as I said, I kept two pictures on my desk when I wrote the book. One of Nancy, one of them was her, she was going to be a nurse. She was going to study to be a nurse, and then I had another picture of her. It was a very unusual situation for me, you know, I just kept thinking about her and thinking about her and thinking about her, because I just kept thinking, man, something went wrong here, you know. This didn't have to happen, but, you know, it is what it is.
You write in the book that the judge said to Tim and to Carol, he addressed both of them, he said, you will spend the rest of your life in prison trying to remember what it's like to be a real human being. So,
isn't that something?
For a story about human beings, yeah, it's really something. Yes,
no, you know, that's unusual. At least, I don't know, Dan, you would know better than I do, because you know this stuff better than me, but that's the first time I've ever heard a judge that, you know, direct, vocal, use any term you want. You know, I mean, it hit home emotionally.
Yeah, no, it's pretty dramatic, even for a judge to, in sentencing even the most heinous of criminals, to say something, but it is pretty profound, really.
It is.
You know, instead of just criticizing them, but it's much beyond that. Fred.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Well,
you talked about book in 2001. This book came out, but this is a re-release in 2015 with Open Road Media.
Yes, sir.
This book in 2001, you said that it changed your perspective. You had a child around this time, story, and now you say it changed your attitude towards the victims of crime. This is a perfect example where it would be hard to, well, not feel bad for Nancy, but also, like many people, they think, well, you shouldn't have done this and you shouldn't have done that and put yourself in harm's way. And how did your attitude change with being a father, Fred, and your attitude towards victims?
Thank you for that question, Dan. The answer is I became a whole lot less judgmental. I didn't look at, you know, I just looked at things from a different perspective. And of course, I also look, you know, I have a daughter, and so any female victims, immediately I think about the fathers and the mothers and so forth of the victims. And that's important because, you know, and I can humanize these people, you know, when you're writing. And and also you realize what your limits are. I mean, I can tell you right now that there's no way in the world I could, you know, everybody talks about JonBenet Ramsey. Not me. I can't touch a case like that. It's this. I can't deal with children that are murdered. It's just off the charts for me. You know. So that all changed when I had a child. So, and I think it made me a better writer. At least I hope it did.
I think so. I think so, Fred. I want to
thank you, buddy.
Fred, very much for talking about needlework, battery acid, heroin, and double murder. Fred, I know that you are in the process of about to get your book published. Tell us just briefly about this book, what it's about. Tell us a little bit about this, your latest book project.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. I wrote a book that I've been wanting to write for 40 years, honestly. It's called Bat Masterson, The First Dreamer. Bat Masterson was an American frontier hero who was the sheriff of Dodge City and later became a crusading reporter in turn of the century New York. Well, it turns out that two things. First, he was involved in seven major murder cases, one of which became known as the trial of the century in the 20th century. And most importantly, I suppose, I had no idea Masterson was a dreamer from Canada. He immigrated to America when he was 8 years old with his parents. And so I just have to tell you that because of the fact that, you know, I've learned to try and not be political, okay, when we're talking. You know, I did my research, and what did I find? Guess what? There's a whole bunch of presidents that have given a hard time to illegal immigrants or supposed illegal immigrants. So there's nothing new about what's happening today, but that's why I felt that Masterson was the first dreamer, but he lied every time that he was asked on the census where he came from, and he would say – he would lie. He never said he came from Canada. He'd say New York, Illinois, whatever. The irony of this is that, Dan, is that right now there's a legal case going on here in the United States where they took that question off the census years ago, where you're from, and now they want to put it back on, and there's a big legal case regarding it. So anyway, I'm talking to a couple of publishers about Bat Masterson, the first dreamer, and you know, and I hope that it's going to get published, and I think it's going to be really good. And I thought, believe me, Dan, I thought about you when I was writing about the murders.
Oh, thanks.
I said to myself, anyway, "Is it Dan's going to like this?"
Absolutely, right. I'm looking forward to reading it. Sounds fascinating. So. Fred, for those that want to find out a little bit more, I guess you have a Facebook page. Do you have a website? Tell us a little bit more about how they might look at all
the
other work.
Anybody want to find out anything about me, you can call the FBI, CIA, and if you can't get through there, you can just go to fredrosen.com or my Facebook page or Open Road Media, which is or Amazon, of course. They carry all my books.
Well, Fred, thank you very much once again for an incredible interview. Thank you very much for Needlework, Battery Acid, Heroin, and Double Murder. Thank you very much, Fred Rosen. You have a great evening.
Dan, thank you so much, and you are the best, sir. Adios.
Thank you. Good night.